ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. This week, we come a little later than I had anticipated, but I will be sharing the last of my exclusive audio from the 2017 TCM Classic Film Festival. Let's start things off light with an introduction by directing trio Jim Abrahams, David, and Jerry Zucker as they discuss their 1984 comedy Top Secret. The talk is being moderated by Dave Carger, in case you're asking who is throwing out all the questions. I'm going to apologize first for the audio, as Abrahams and the Zuckers tend to talk over each other. But that makes for some great comedy in one of the second funniest intros that I've seen in the fest. First still goes to Edgar Wright, which you guys listened to last week. But their discussion is hilarious, as evidenced by all the laughter, and that makes up for a somewhat lackluster film. Top Secret is a fun spoof of the Bond movies as well as teen musicals, but your mileage is going to vary based on how much you enjoy immature humor. It's no Airplane, that's for sure. So let's listen in.
I want to congratulate you all for being here because you all could have been watching The Graduate right now, but instead you're here, and I love The Graduate, but it means that you're my people. I have the pleasure of bringing out the three guys responsible for Kentucky Fried Movie, Airplane, Ruthless People, The Naked Gun, and of course, Top Secret. Please welcome the number one directorial menage a trois in cinema history, Jim Abrahams, Jerry Zucker, and David Zucker. Sat in ZAZ formation. This is kind of crazy. I'm loving the whole thing. So this film, Top Secret, that we're about to see tonight spoofs so many films. Of course, there's a Wizard of Oz spoof near the end. There's a great Blue Lagoon thing going on. But at its heart, it's spoofing teen musicals and it's spoofing spy films. How did you guys figure out that those two spoofs could work together in one spoof, like a peanut butter and chocolate kind of thing?
And that was our first mistake.
I'm not sure that they did actually in fact work together.
They did.
We got into old World War II movies, the kind that were made during World War II, and I think in the ending credits they usually said, buy war bonds in this theater, and we just loved the seriousness of it. And there were many cliches, like, you know, when they'd sneak up behind a German sentry, they could always be sure of knocking them out. I mean, if German sentries could hear, possibly they would have won the war. You know, we identified all those great cliches, and then we also liked Elvis movies. I don't know why.
But Elvis movies were great. I mean, they were, they were fun. And they were laughable. I mean, but it just satirized anything. We had to both find it laughable and love it. You know, we have to have affection for it, and which we had for both of those genres. And I think what happened is we couldn't really decide which one to do, so we said, well, let's combine them. And, you know, it was, I don't know that they really combined that well, but it was still a fun film.
Yeah, and when you think about it, the parodies that are done best, single genre, like Blazing Saddles, or Young Frankenstein, you know, or Airplane, or Scary Movie, and they pick one genre. So we thought we'd be really clever to pick two.
And those other movies had a three-act structure and a character arc.
That's something you guys might consider plot. I was flabbergasted to remind myself that this is Val Kilmer's first ever film, a Juilliard graduate. Of course he's going to do a movie like Top Secret and play an Elvis-type pop star and do all the crazy stuff that you have to do. How did you find him?
There were a number of actors who auditioned, and you know, we went to New York to see a play he was in. It's called Slab Boys.
Slab Boys, and it was Val and Sean Penn and Kevin Bacon and one of that, I forget who the fourth guy was. But there were four, you know, and they were in some...
Alan Dershowitz.
way he played, and that's what he meant.
And why did you see him and think, this is our guy?
He sang one of the songs, or some song.
Yeah.
Well, in an audition.
He came into the audition just completely prepared. He'd studied Elvis, and he knew the moves, and he practiced singing some songs, and he just kind of blew us away. He's great. Plus, he was gorgeous.
That was Jim's opinion. They dated for a while.
In a very nuts and bolts kind of way, how do three guys direct a movie? I read, Jerry, that you were behind the camera, and Jim and David, you guys were like at a video village kind of monitor situation. Is that true? How did it all work?
I think
it wasn't really that difficult.
Good night, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much.
Vail
was beautiful, though.
You should never ask that.
Is it democratic when you guys have a disagreement? Is it a two?
Well, actually, it is. It's always two out of three, so that usually works.
If multiple people can direct the film together, it just has to be an odd number.
Right. Yeah, four would not work.
Four would work. Five would be great.
Coen Brothers don't know how they do it. What do you guys recall as being the type of things that you would need to do some kind of vote on to solve an issue, a disagreement?
We wrote the script together. So we were so of a mind by the time we got to the set that there were very, very few disputes once we got on the set. And most of the hashing out took place during the whole writing.
And a lot of it is casting, sets, wardrobe, just all that stuff that goes on before you get to the set.
Yeah. And then in editing again. But on the set, we just had to move fast, and so we couldn't take time to sit and have long arguments.
There's so many memorable sequences, scenes, lines that I want to ask you about a couple of them, because I would imagine that a lot of people in this theater are not seeing this movie for the first time tonight. The incredible underwater action saloon fight sequence near the end. I can only imagine how many days you spent doing just that. How many?
I think that was 4 hours.
No.
That was several days, but once again, everything, we like the backwards scene, which was always also a really difficult one, we really prepared everything. We rehearsed it. We spent a whole day rehearsing it over and over, and then a whole day, you know, shooting it. And the same thing with the underwater. We really just worked out all the bits very carefully. It obviously, working underwater is takes a bit of time, but I think it probably was 3 days.
I think that most of those shots were under crank, so that it sped up the action. Yeah, but that didn't help us make the date. But, yeah. Right.
I just don't know how Val and how they even saw each other. I mean, I'm too wimpy to open my eyes underwater in a swimming pool, but I just don't understand how you can have your wherewithal underwater and see what's going on and be able to fake the punches and all the things that went on. It's just mind-bending how they did it.
They were fully functioning human beings. I'm not sure what your issues are. Open their eyes underwater. And then of course we would soak them open so they couldn't close them. They were great. Once again, it was a lot of rehearsal underwater, and there would be, you know, it was broken up into little pieces, and there would be stunt guys with air hoses, you know, that would come in and immediately for them to give them some air. And they actually had some kind of thing, speaker that worked underwater. It was a special speaker so that they could actually hear what we were saying up above.
Wow. And the backwards scene that you mentioned, did that come from this idea that people say that Swedish language sounds like English being spoken backwards? Is that where this idea came from?
Right, yeah. We, if you play English backwards, right, it sounds like Swedish, I guess.
It came from when we were in high school, and know, this is before video, so they have 16 millimeter projectors, and when you run them backwards, the sound would be, you know, that, and we loved that for some reason. That made us laugh. And
I went to Sweden once, and sure enough, they're going, that's the type of
person. But that's one shot, right? So how many times did you allow yourselves to get it until you...
17.
Really?
Yeah, it took 17 takes. The shot actually starts with the dog
right.
coming in. So in the movie, it's the last thing in the shot, but it starts with the dog coming in. So they brought three stunt dogs.
Very expensive
stunt dogs. To come in to go to the bowl and eat. And each one got tired of eating. So I had to let them go in. So finally, the guy who was the set decorator, the production.
Peter Levant, the production designer, also did the James Bond movies.
Went home and got his dog. And his dog's the one who's in the movie.
And he would just eat take after take, you know, to rip him away from that.
Dozens of takes that dog could
steal. It's so good.
When it comes to all of the priceless sight gags that people are going to see again, like when they're looking through the binoculars and there's the black kind of outline of binoculars that the guy then walks over, or the boots that you pan up and see that it's just boots with nobody in them. Did you guys have a master list of these kind of cliched shots from spy movies and think, okay, let's figure out how we can insert these, or did it all happen organically as you were writing it?
We worked from about 20 of these movies. And I think they did have all these cliches in it. So as we would watch, we'd say, hey, how about, you know, what can we do with this? But how could this be bent in such a way to make people laugh? Right? So that's how we did it.
I mean, there's so much stuff in here that, like, the 12-year-old that's still inside me just loves, like, the anal intruder, and the male ballet dancers with their huge kind of, like, bulge, and the pigeon statue that poops. I mean, do you guys feel like you're 12?
You have a 12-year-old inside you? You should do something about that, really.
Do you feel like that side of you has remained a big part of your personalities, or is it you trying to imagine what people like me who have 12-year-olds inside me will actually like?
Actually, people have, you know, sometimes asked us whether we write for a younger audience, and the truth is we always write for ourselves, but fortunately we're really immature.
That's helpful. One scene that I was thinking about as well is when Val is in that prison cell and he goes in like one little trap door and then comes out another and then comes out the other side and through the top. Was that 30 years ago considered like super high tech? What you guys did, or was it actually fairly easy to accomplish?
Yeah, I think they just froze the camera. So the camera is frozen, and so he poked his head out of one thing, and then cut, and then poked his head out of another thing. So actually, it wasn't technically complicated at all.
What went through?
Can I tell one story?
Please.
Sorry, we're out of time, Jim.
No, we're not.
Tell the story. This is my favorite story of Top Secret, and we had a phenomenal year together. We were living in London, and got per diems, and the British back then anyway had short shooting days, so we could travel and look around London and around Europe. And my favorite time of the whole experience is after the movie came out, and it kind of tanked. And it didn't get good reviews, and it didn't do very well at the box office, but you know, as you got to kind of soldier on and continue to promote it, even though you know for sure it's not a success. So we were at a film festival in
Australia.
Paris.
Yeah,
we were promoting the movie, and we were kind of tired and cranky and, you know, upset that the movie didn't work very well. And then we were answering a bunch of questions from journalists and stuff like that. And so then they brought out a cow, and I'm sure anybody who's seen this movie knows the cows in the movie. So they brought out a cow, and they had us pose with the cow. We were getting crankier and crankier. And they said, "In front of the cow, next to the cow, they had to look the cow." And then finally the photographer said, "Now kiss the cow." And Jerry said, "You kiss the fucking cow."
I do not, no. Neither did Ian.
I really get the feeling that you guys are huge Downton Abbey fans, like me. What went through your mind when you saw that your own deja vu, Jim Carter, became so huge as
Mr. Really Larson. Weird last name, but anyway, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You're Carter, right.
Mine's Carter, which sounds like Carter, exactly. But how cool is that, that he had this incredible renaissance?
It was great. I mean, I just had to keep, you know, not thinking about Jim Carter, you know, sneezing into his hands and then looking at it and jumping out the window. He wouldn't have done that as a head buff. But he was in town, you know, he's been nominated for multiple Emmys.
Yes.
And so when he was in town, I think it was a couple of years ago, we found out about him and we called him and we all had lunch. It was a great little mini reunion.
I love it. In a general sense, I think there's a lot of filmmakers, comedic filmmakers working today who would cite you guys as major influences. Since we're here at a TCM event, who are some directors that influenced you all the most, or writers for that matter?
Well, there's a strange, really weird director we met early on named John Landis.
Never heard of him.
That's right. Really, the first movie set we were on was Kentucky Fried Movie. And so, unfortunately, that was the example we had. No, we did. We learned, we kind of said, okay, well, I guess that's how you direct a movie.
When we wanted to write our first script, you know, we went out to lunch with Landis. We said we want to write a movie, and Landis had already done a movie called Schlock. So he said, well, first you have to write a script. And we said, well, we know, but what does one look like? And that's how green we were. And so he ran out to his car and opened the trunk. He brought us a script to American Werewolf in London. And so we used that, and we actually made that movie. No. But we used that for the form, just to know, you know, where to do the indentation and where to do a slug. So that's...
A couple small things. I love the moment near the beginning where there's the find him and kill him stamp. Who has that stamp?
I have this stamp.
But I have the anal intruder. I mean, it's on a show, I don't know. Right. Don't just a mom.
We can talk about it later.
I use the stamp all the time, David.
I'll tell them what you do with a stamp.
Jim, what's your most prized? So we know about the anal intruder and the stamp. What's your most prized keepsake from this film set?
Thank you.
I don't know that I have any memorabilia.
We didn't give him any.
We always told Jim that you weren't allowed to keep them.
I have a painting that Val paints on the train.
Oh, the blurry thing. Yeah. Oh my God!
I have a lot of great stuff.
And I have Val Kilmer.
Val Kilmer lives down the block from me now.
So before we let you guys go, tell everybody what's interesting or different about this director's cut that we're going to see right now. What's added or subtracted?
We had seen the movie play at Sketchfest around, I don't know, five years ago, and the movie played great, but there were certain moments that just made us cringe, so we just cut them out. It's short, actually. Most director's cuts are longer than director's add-back, you know, scenes that, you know, the big bad studio cut out, but we shortened it. So,
the fucking studio left in too much.
What's gone? Especially for people who know the movie, it would be interesting to see what they think. But I can tell you there is one new shot, and that was shot by Jerry in his backyard on his cell phone.
That's going to stick out.
Yes, and I sent it to Anthony Weiner, and...
the shop is in the movie.
Well, listen, I want everyone to know, first of all, enjoy the movie, but also stick around later because at midnight, these guys will be back with John Landis and one of my favorite film directors working today, Edgar Wright, who's here right now, for another chat about Kentucky Fried Movie. So enjoy that. What a pleasure it is to meet you and talk to you.
This next clip is from television personality Tara McNamara talking about the 1950 George Cukor comedy Born Yesterday. Born Yesterday was probably one of the best film audience experiences that I've had, not just in a festival setting, but in general. People laughed uproariously at the political satire alongside the story of Billy Don, expertly played by Judy Holliday. McNamara herself gets into dissecting the film's satirical stylings, but you really have to watch the movie to be dazzled at how sharp and witty the whole thing is. Here's Tara's intro, and right afterwards, you should go watch the movie. I'll wait.
Osborne. Woo! Influenced my life without ever having met me. In 2002, my son was 7 or 8 years old, and I was struggling to find something that we could watch together. TV had really become demographically targeted, and it was really hard to find stuff that would be appropriate for him and that we would both enjoy. And we stumbled upon TCM. And not only TCM, it was Robert Osborne. It's the way that Robert Osborne gives you an introduction. He weaves a story. He tells you things so that you have to stay and watch the movie. You have to find out what he was talking about. And of course, hear what he was going to say at the end to tie it all up. So it really became a thing for us where we, you know, where we would just go through the schedule and then we would schedule our lives around what was on TCM. And then as Sean explained, we went on to create a business and it really gave me an entirely different career. And I cannot believe that now I'm part of the TCM Film Festival for something that I just started watching with my son. So I'm so grateful to Robert Osborne for that. So I will try and do my best Robert Osborne now. Screenwriters say that an easy key to success is writing about what you know. And so I think the question when it comes to Born Yesterday is, well, what is it that Garson Kanin knew about dumb blondes? And I think that you have to look closer at Billy Don, because Billy Don is no ordinary dumb blonde. Garson Kanin wrote the play Born Yesterday during World War II. So he was serving in the Department of the Armed Services that became the CIA, and he was mainly focused on making propaganda and war effort films. But from that position, he was alarmed to see and witness firsthand the corruption that was going on in Washington. He wanted the American public to know about it, and he wanted them to protest. But there was a little bit of a problem of trying to bring it to their attention at that time, and that is that America's trust in government was running at an all-time high. I mean, you know, it was like the Depression conquered of Nazis, defeated, Hitler dead, you know, America's high-fiving each other, and American exceptionalism was really just revving its engine. So how could he get everyone to say, hey, maybe you should look at what's going on over here? What did he do? He wrote a play. He didn't write a movie because he thought no studio would ever make this movie. It'll be far too controversial. But he thought, I'll make a play. I'll write a play about a scrap metal mogul who goes to Capitol Hill to buy a senator. And along the way, you know, he brings his girlfriend and he decides that she needs some refining, so he'll hire this Washington reporter to smarten her up. So what Kanin saw as bribery was really the beginning of what we call lobbying now. And so when there's buying a senator, that was like pretty shocking then, but we're like, yeah, so, okay, happens all the time, right? And so he really wanted the American public to question, to think independently, and to fight back. And so, the dumb blonde that you see as Billy Don is really the United States of America. And, Vanno, before you get too offended, I also want to point out that Billy Don isn't really dumb as much as she is ignorant. It's not that she doesn't have the capacity to learn, it's that she chooses not to, and she says so in the film. She says, you know, all I need to know is how to get what I want, and as long as I know that, I'm good. She says more, I just totally paraphrased that and wrote it. That's not what she says, but something like that. And so she thinks that she has everything she wants. So the only thing that makes her challenge herself to learn is because she's crushing on her instructor. And who wouldn't crush on Bill Holden, right? You're like, I can relate to that. William Holden's character character is this highly intelligent Paul Renau, the Washington journalist, and he also begins crushing on Billy Dawn, and a woman who seems not couth, as she would say. And so at first it may seem a little far-fetched, but then again, you have to really pay attention to the film. So Paul Renau never puts down Billy Dawn for her lack of knowledge. He is very protective of her, in fact. And so that's where you realize that Paul Renau is an avatar for Garson Kanin. So he loves America, he wants to protect America by educating America, and he's doing it through this film. And so here's the other thing. So we, the audience, do laugh at Billy Dawn, like when she doesn't know what the Supreme Court is, and we're rolling our eyes at her. But see, at that moment, then we establish that we, the audience, are morally and intellectually superior to Billy Dawn. So as you're laughing at her, so then as she, you have to know what she doesn't know, right? So by the end of the movie, when she's talking about Thomas Paine, you're thinking, oh, when I get home, I might have to brush up on my Thomas Paine. And that's how he educated us. Of course, the play really was much too controversial to be made into a film, so a lot of the political jabs were dialed down quite a bit. There's a lot of stuff that they made less immoral. I mean, there's one thing I'd like to point out, which is there's this scene that seems kind of strange where they have Billy Dawn walk through a hallway. They're sharing a suite at this hotel, she and her billionaire boyfriend, Harry Brock. And they have her walk through this hallway. And it seems really odd, but the reason they did it is they were trying to make it look like they were not living together.
Yeah, right.
They are also engaged now in the film as opposed to the play. So there's little things like that. Find the afterword, we'll talk about them. But I do want to say that, you know, while the film was too controversial and they did dial down the politics, you know, Garson Kanin was trying to influence us, and it didn't go unnoticed by the House Un-American Activities Committee. So in 1950, the year that Born Yesterday premiered, you know, Garson Kanin got called in, Ruth Gordon, his wife, who also helped draft the play into the screenplay for the film, uncredited, but she also was targeted, and so was Judy Holliday, the film's star. So Judy Holliday, by all accounts, when she was called to go speak before the government committee on it, she transformed herself back into Billy Dawn, and she got off the hook by playing dumb. So from 1950, here is Judy Holliday's Oscar-winning performance in Born Yesterday.
I know you've already heard Peter Bogdanovich talk on a previous episode, but I've got another auditory delight from him as he introduced his 1972 homage to screwball comedy What's Up, Doc? Bogdanovich is always fun to listen to, and be sure to keep an ear open for his excellent impersonation of Jimmy Stewart. As far as the film is concerned, I love Madeline Kahn. She's the main reason to watch this. But despite Bogdanovich's good intentions, his send-up of bringing a baby never really worked for me. Mostly because Ryan O'Neal lacks the charm and humor of someone like Cary Grant, and Barbra Streisand just doesn't seem at ease playing a daffy comedienne like Katharine Hepburn. However, considering that everybody else seemed to laugh around me, maybe I'm in the minority on this one. Either way, once again, Peter Bogdanovich.
Have you enjoyed this 3-day trip down memory lane?
Yep.
Yeah.
I can tell.
Actually, I have. I saw the last picture show yesterday. It's a sad movie.
Nobody warned you?
I didn't know it was that sad.
You know, one thing I was really interested in, because I sat and listened to the great conversation that you did with Ben Mankiewicz the other day, and you were talking about a lot of the extensive studies and interviews that you've done with master filmmakers like Orson Welles and John Ford. And one thing that you said is that you find more often than not that the directors share character traits with the films that they make. If that's true, how are you like What's Up, Doc?
Well, when I was in kindergarten, I did a Bugs Bunny impression. And they called me Bugs. For all through high school, Bugs. What's up, Doc? That was a big hit.
Would you consider yourself zany? Would you consider yourself...
I love screwball comedies. They're my favorite genre. Pictures like The Awful Truth, The Lady Eve, 20th Century, His Girl Friday, Bringing Up Baby. I love those films. So I wanted to make one like it. Not like it, but in that tradition. That's what What's Up, Doc? Turned out to be.
So obviously there's a moment early in the movie where we see Barbra Streisand in that gift store with the carrot, chewing on it, saying, "What's up, Doc?" So what came first, the title of the movie and then that's why you put that line in, or was that a moment in the movie that then became the title?
Actually, David Newman said, why don't we call it What's Up, Doc? It was his idea. And I loved the title because it's a catchphrase that we all grew up with. And then we, of course, we put it into the picture.
Right.
I think the title came first.
And what's interesting is that your first two films, Targets and Last Picture Show, were rated R. This one is rated G. You just don't see non-animated rated G movies, certainly this day and age. What was it about that that you wanted to explore?
Well, the studio said, don't you want a PG or a PG?
PG-13 didn't even exist then.
I said, no, I want to make a G-rated picture with no socially redeeming value. They said, all right. And the picture became very successful. And one of the reasons, I think, was because it was not a cartoon. And you could take, adults, parents could take their kids and they didn't have to worry about seeing something that they didn't want their kids to see, but they could enjoy it because it's, you know, fairly adult. Mm.
Was it challenging to keep it G, to take any potentially adult or PG moments out, or did it feel very natural and organic the whole way through?
Well, we did, the writers and I, we had three writers, it turned out. We all agreed that it was going to be two things. A G-rated picture and no contemporary references that were dated, like somebody saying about Johnny Carson last night, or who the president was, or any of that stuff. There's only one line that's slightly of a certain period, but I won't tell you what that is. It's at the end of the picture. But it works anyway, because we did an extra bit of shtick with it.
And my understanding is that you and Ryan O'Neill were definitely going for a Cary Grant feel with his performance. And Ryan even consulted Cary before he
called. I called Cary and I said, will you talk to Ryan about this? We're doing a, you know, screwball comedy. And I was friendly with Cary. And he said, sure, send him over. So Ryan went to see him. And he came back. I said, what did he say? He said, he told me to wear silk underpants.
That's the trick.
Yeah, I called Cary and I said, guess what? My new movie's opening at the Radio City Music Hall. The Radio City Music Hall in New York was at that point still the greatest, the premier showcase for family pictures that the whole family could go to see, and even some serious pictures. And Cary said, that's nice. I had 28 pictures play the hall. I said, 28 pictures? Yes, all my pictures played the music hall. I tell you what you must do. Put on a raincoat and sunglasses, but you won't need that. But just go there and stand in the back. And you listen and you watch while 6,500 people laugh at something you did. It will do your heart good. And I did. And it was great, I must say.
I read that Barbra Streisand didn't think that she was funny in this movie. Is that
no,
true?
She didn't think the picture was funny. This came about because of Barbra, and so I'm going to tell you what happened. Early on, Picture Show was getting a buzz about it before anybody really had seen it. And Barbra asked, Warner Brothers asked Barbra to do a picture, and she was considering doing it, and she wanted a director, and they heard that The Last Picture Show was a good film, so we had a special screening for Barbra of a work print. She loved it and really cried and was very moved by it, and said she wanted to work with me. I said, well, I'd like to work with you. She said, let's do a drama, she said. I said, no, I just did a drama, let's do a comedy. She said, well, I just did a comedy. I said, well, that's how it goes. So John Callie, who was then the head of Warner Brothers, called me in his office, and I went to see him. He said, Peter, Barbra really wants to work with you. I said, well, I'd like to work with her too, but I don't like the script that you wanted us to do. And he said, well, look, if you had to do a picture with Barbra Streisand, what would you do? I said, well, I don't know, screwball comedy, you know, Daffy Dane, Square Professor, she screws everything up and everything turns out all right, you know, like bringing a baby. He said, do it. I said, really? He said, yeah, do it. So I left I said, can I produce it? He said, sure. So I left the studio producing and directing Barbra Streisand's next picture, but nobody knew what it was. We got the writers and we started working on it, and Barbra, we told her the title, she said, Barbra Streisand and What's Up, Doc? She didn't like that. But she was fun. She got into it, and we had a lot of fun making the picture.
All right.
On the commentary track that's on the DVD, they asked her, what was it like? She said, well, I don't know. She said, I just come on the set, he tell me what to do, and I do it, and that was it. And it's pretty much what we did. I mean, Barbara was very accommodating. We got along very well. I remember her agent called me and said, are you giving Barbara Streisand line readings? That's where I do the line the way I wanted to do it. And she said, well, I said, I work that way. Sometimes I do. They don't have to do it exactly that way, but it just gives you an idea. And Barbara was getting ready to sing the song As Time Goes By, As Time Goes By. And I said, you know that line, on that you can rely? She said, yeah. Will you hit can? She said, now you're telling me how to do the song? I said, we'll try it. And she tried it, it worked, and so I was happy with that.
Not only that, but you got on the piano, too. Before huh? you got on the piano, too, as we saw in the...
Oh, well, that was funny, because it was a complicated camera move, because Barbara had to get off the piano, and the camera had to move around the piano while she was getting off. So it was a complicated camera move. And the director of photography, Laszlo Kovacs, says to me, Barbara's in makeup, so would you do the move for us? So I didn't know he was going to shoot it. So I did the whole thing, and they shot. Next day, John Kelly calls me and says, have you seen the dailies yet? I said, no. He says, you're in for a good treat. I said, really? And there it comes, oh my God, he shot it. They used it in the trailer, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really? I've got to ask you about the person who steals this movie, which is Madeline Kahn. Who had never been in a film before, and I can't imagine someone getting the third lead in a Ryan O'Neill, Barbara Streisand, Peter Bogdanovich picture, having never made a movie before. How did you find her?
Well, I went to New York to do a little casting, and I cast Austin Pendleton, who, but I met him in New York. He plays the rich guy. He's terrific. And the casting woman, Nessa Himes, brought Madeline in to see me. She was doing a Broadway show at the time. I didn't have time to go see the show. And she came in, we talked, and she made me, I started laughing. She said, why are you laughing? I said, you're funny. She said, I am. She never thought she was funny. When she saw this picture, she went to the Radio City Music Hall and saw the picture. And she went into therapy afterward. She said, everybody's laughing at me. I said, that's supposed to be. She got into, she was very funny. But she didn't think she was funny. In fact, she was so funny in the table read, she'd say, Howard, and everybody'd laugh. And Barbara and Ryan didn't get one laugh. Which usually happens in table reads because the stars aren't playing it, you know? And Barbara got very upset. She said, I'm an extra in this picture. Come on, Barbara, you're not an extra.
Is it true that the amazing long car chase was 25% of the budget of the movie?
Yeah, I guess it was. The picture cost $4.6 million, which is nothing compared to today's private pictures. But the John Kelly called me the first day of shooting. We were in San Francisco in the airport. And John says, you know, the chase is going to cost $1 million. I said, well, that's fine. He said, can you cut it down a little bit? I said, no, I think it's going to be the high point of the picture. Well, he says, look, we could make a deal with McDonald's. Can you bring McDonald's into it? I said, I can have them wreck a McDonald's. He said, no, forget it.
But my understanding is that the city of San Francisco was not thrilled with your production.
Well, we'll see, there's a scene where they're going down some stairs, and the taxi chips, well, he doesn't chip it, he wrecks a couple of stairs. They got a little bit annoyed with us. Warner Brothers fixed it up. It was okay.
A couple last things before we let people watch the movie. There's, of course, for the people who know this movie well, there's that great exchange of dialogue, spoofing, knocking the love means never having to say your sorry line from Love Story. Was Ryan O'Neill at all hesitant in knocking a movie that he had just done 2 years
no,
prior?
No, he thought it was funny, yeah. Ryan was very malleable. He'd never done a comedy, and particularly not a comedy like this. So I helped him a lot. Buck Henry said, Ryan O'Neal was doing Peter Bogdanovich doing Cary Grant. I gave him a lot of the moves and so on. But Ryan was wonderful to work with. He was everybody was terrific on the picture. We had no temperament. We came in a day under schedule, actually.
Wow. Well, if there's one thing I've learned about you these last 3 days is that you do fantastic impressions of many different people. We've already heard some of them just in these last 10 minutes. Do you do a better Ryan O'Neal or Barbara Streisand?
Can't do either of them. I can do Jimmy Stewart.
Great.
Oh, well, I tell you, I don't know what to say now. I had nothing to do with this picture. Called Jimmy Stewart and I said, "How you feeling, Jimmy?" "Well, I'll tell you, Peter. After 70, it's all patch, patch, patch."
Mr. Stewart, would you like to introduce our film this afternoon?
Not particularly. No.
Well, then I'll do it. Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, Peter Bogdanovich, everybody. Thank you so much for being.
This next clip is from my favorite film discovery of this year's festival, 1967's Barefoot in the Park. This delightful romantic comedy stars Jane Fonda and Robert Redford, which should be more than enough reason for you to seek it out. Unfortunately, Warner hasn't put out a DVD of this one in a while, and a Blu-ray isn't available, so Warner, get on that. Fonda and Redford have excellent comedic timing, and Mildred Natwick actually runs away with the entire picture. If I can swing it, I want to do a full episode on this movie because it is just that amazing. Filmstruck host Alicia Malone introduced this, and though it's short on revelations, I think she's saving the best for the actual film itself. So let's listen to her.
I feel so lucky to be here with all of you guys because most of the year I feel like an outsider because I'm talking about, you know, Cary Grant, and I just feel like I'm out of place. But here at the TCM Classic Film Festival, I feel like you guys are my tribe. So I love being here with you. And you're about to see, obviously, such a fantastic movie. One of my all-time favorites, Barefoot in the Park, from 1967, starring the brilliant Jane Fonda and Robert Redford. And I love reading about the making of this film because there's so many different relationships, so many 6 degrees of separation. Because it started out as a Broadway play, very successful, written by Neil Simon. The play was directed by Mike Nichols, and Robert Redford starred in the play alongside Elizabeth Ashley. And then when the film version came around, Gene Sachs joined as director, and he and Neil Simon had a long relationship of writer-director on stage and on the screen. And Robert Redford didn't think he was going to get the film role because he had recently been passed over for the film version of Sunday in New York, which he also performed on Broadway. But he got cast in the role, and then alongside him was Jane Fonda, who had actually been in the film version of Sunday in New York. And these two had made a film beforehand called The Chase, but they became really good friends on Barefoot in the Park, and you can see that chemistry. It's got the brilliant screenplay adapted by Neil Simon himself, and it's so full of wit, so full of a romance. It says a lot of truths about being married and living in a tiny apartment in New York, and it ended up being a huge success. For Robert Redford, it was his first big box office success, and for Jane Fonda, she had critical success for the first time, where people could see that she was a brilliant actress and not just a beautiful face. And these two had such a great relationship. They're now making another movie together, which I can't wait to see them back on the screen together. That's going to be so exciting. And then Mike Nichols loved working with Robert Redford on Broadway and was so impressed with him in this film that then, of course, he wanted him to audition for The Graduate. But the role went to the lovely Dustin Hoffman, which was brilliant and perfect. So many different behind-the-scenes little relationships here, and that all culminates in this beautiful film. You guys are going to have such a fun afternoon, so please enjoy your time with Barefoot in the Park. Thank you, guys. I'll see you around.
And last but certainly not least, you're going to want to get out your hankies for this because we're concluding with Ben Mankiewicz's interview with Richard Dreyfuss and Todd Fisher, following a screening of 1990s Postcards from the Edge in tribute to Debbie Reynolds and Carrie Fisher. I didn't edit this much to avoid losing out on Dreyfuss and Fisher's discussion, which quickly turned highly emotional. There wasn't a dry eye in the house, and you'll have to forgive me for sniffling on the recording. The film, though, takes dramatic liberties, as Fisher and Dreyfuss point out, but it's still a sweet tale of mother and daughter. You can easily see the similarities to the relationship between Debbie Reynolds and Carrie Fisher. It was actually amazing. Afterwards, I ran into Richard Dreyfuss's wife, who mentioned that this was the first time that Richard had actually cried and expressed some type of emotion following the death of his best friend. And that makes this moment even more cathartic and also very, very upsetting. This was such a beautiful film to watch, and it was wonderful to have a cathartic moment to grieve during a festival that was already jam-packed with sadness in the wake of Robert Osborne's death. So let's give it over to Todd, Richard, and Ben.
Todd Fisher and Richard Dreyfuss.
Thank you for joining us for some of our little Sunday afternoon home movies. Is this what you all do for your home movies? Just put little things together like this?
Man, that is a fun movie. First of all, let's get a couple things about Postcards from the Edge clear for people. Just how much, you know, it's Carrie's book and Carrie's screenplay. How much of that from her life? How much did she, was an artist's interpretation of her life?
Well, there's some truth when I'm joking there saying it's home movies. And many things about this are real. I mean, there's a lot of real quotes. The skirt did twirl up, I was there. Now, you'd think it would have traumatized me as much as it did Carrie, but what can I tell you? It was shocking, but it didn't, you know, didn't send me in a tailspin. Many years at the premiere of this film, a woman walked up to my mother and she said, she reached out her hand and she said, "You know, my dear, I'm so, so sorry." My mother said, "My dear, it's only a movie." So I think that, in effect, tells the story. Yes, there's tons of true stuff in here. And my grandmother, Maxine, there, that is her.
That's her, yeah.
My sister didn't know my grandfather quite as well because he's just as wild and wacky as my grandmother in many ways. But there are things about this movie that are real accurate, including Richard's part.
There's one thing that you should know, and that is that in real life...
Don't you start. Oh. I'll have to start. We're not all over this yet, as you can possibly imagine.
I haven't done this. I haven't since... The one thing you should know is that Debbie Reynolds was so proud for 25 years to hold her daughter's coat. There was no jealousy, there was no competition. She was mom and her daughter succeeded. And it was, we all were people who at one time or another kind of broke into their love affair, but the whole notion that Debbie would have, you know, wanted to take Carrie's place is such bullshit.
Yeah.
That was the problem with the director. You know, he, Mike, as great as he is, you know, he did, there were things he saw. That was stuff he brought to it. And I'll tell you that Carrie and I were frustrated by that stuff, of course. And years later, we even shied away from making movies as personal because of the potential for that sort of misuse of things. So, you know, Richard's one of the most amazing guys because he sees that. Many people don't know, you know, about the purity of my mother and the desire, above all things, that her children succeed.
Yeah. Debbie, the two of them were like, there are no words to really describe it. Debbie was fantastic, bright, open, cheerful, happy, encouraging, witty, with strength and bright brilliance. And if she turned and wanted to, she could take you down in a second. And Carrie was Carrie. And Carrie is indescribable. I will say that at her memorial, when we first met at the house, some of the most brilliant people in the world got up and were crying and saying these eloquent, wonderful things. And I was sitting and standing in the back near Penny, and I realized that Carrie was gone and that we were no longer connected to each other. Carrie had lassoed us all together into something special, and after she died, we were just a bunch of interesting people standing in a room. And without her, a lot of the meaning of our being there went away. And I guess what was left was personal, you know. I didn't cry. I didn't cry at all. Not until now. And I feel a void in the world that Carrie and her mother are gone. Mostly Carrie for me, but she had a way with words that were indescribable. And the only thing I can compare it to, literally, is when I tried to read as a kid The Brothers Karamazov, and I didn't have the courage to turn the page. It was just too much. He knew too much about me, and I didn't have the courage to read it. And that's how I felt about her writing. When you read Carrie, she takes a word, turns it inside out, gives it 16 different meanings, and they're all about you. There are lots of times when I just put it away, pushed it away. But she was my... The greatest compliment I've ever gotten on this planet is when Carrie said that we were of the same egg.
Uh-oh.
And that was both a recognition of our both as impressive and we were great.
Todd was so kind enough to ask me to speak at the public memorial for Debbie and Carrie last month, and I delivered a line that got a laugh, but I really meant it. You know, Carrie is a hero of mine, but I never met her. You don't always want to meet your heroes, and I was afraid to meet Carrie because I thought if there's anybody out there who will see through me and expose me for whatever kind of fraud I am, like, it'll be Carrie Fisher. She'll know.
She didn't always do that to people.
No, I'm sure she wouldn't have. I'm sure she would have spared you from my mother's. Well, I just mean, you know, my perception is that you know when you're meeting somebody insightful, somebody who is seeing things on a different plane.
True.
And so that made me nervous. I would have loved to have met her, but that's what made me nervous.
It also came from my mother. My mother had a depth of character to her that was a gift, a spiritual gift that was handed to Carrie, whether she recognized it all at once. But her words, of course, reflected it, as Richard points out. But there's a depth to those girls that I have never witnessed before.
It's a great secret. And I had it when I was doing a play at the Mark Tabor years ago, and Carrie always had it. And it was that if you had no secrets, no one could hurt you. And Carrie would have said to you, "I know who you are because I'm as inauthentic as you are." That's how she would have known who you are, because she would. There was nothing held back. I feel from either one. A perfect example of a human being who survived Hollywood, and the proof was in her mother, who never left, you know, Oz, and Carrie had this. She didn't have a cruel bone in her body. She would never have nailed you, ever. She would have recognized you because it was in her. And we both used to talk about the fact that you know, no one was ever going to call us up before a committee and say, well, Mr. Dreyfuss, we happen to have a document here. And I would say, I've already talked about that document, fuck you.
True, Carrie, every story she's ever told. The one thing about Carrie is these stories that you're seeing here are small snapshots of Carrie's life. And there are others that haven't been told, that some of which have been written, some were not. Debbie, of course, did biography work where you can read her whole life story, but Carrie never did a biography because we never thought the biography, we never thought we were at the end. Even what's being talked about here is kind of interesting because you'll notice how she, the character Shirley's playing, she's saying, well, you know, it, my turn is over, or we're at the end. Isn't that a joke? Because this is 30 years ago. I mean, Debbie's career was booming like a year ago. She just did Vegas. I mean, you know, it's like she could have done whatever she wanted for as long as she wanted.
There's also something else, having not seen the film in so long. It's the most wonderful devotional respect and love for movie making. And the looks that they give each other and the other people, Gene Hackman and the guys on the crew, and when you do it right, when you're in the zone, and Meryl, boy.
Oh my God.
Meryl was and is the most extraordinarily talented, unique human being, actress in the world. She played this role, and there were moments as an actor that I just stopped and went, motherfucker. And then they did that great thing. You are playing, by the way. When you make a film, if you think about it, you are playing to the guys on the fourth tier. You are trying to move them. And they usually don't pay any attention until you're lucky. And when they showed that, and there she was, that was perfect. Was it an evil or envious moment?
There was a scene, the showing of Shirley there was interesting. We were up at Carrie's house. This is before she had the house she has now, up at Oak Pass. And Shirley came to me and she said, you know, I'm about to play your mother. And I'd love to get your thoughts on, you know, what you think. And I said, Shirley, you are my mother. And she kind of looked at me with that, you know, she has those twinkly little eyes like that. And she said, that's it? I'm like, it would be a crime for me to say anything more than that. Just think about that. That's it. You are. In so many ways, she was a very, very much, and is very much like my mom. She's a glorious person and has that bright spirit like my mother has.
Gabriel, we got to wrap this up, but as an outsider, I know. But I want to, Richard, I'm not an actor, and ever be one, but it strikes me that, like, the director that Gene Hackman played, like, man, that's who you want to work for, right? I mean, that's it, because when he needed to be tough, he was tough, but it was all in pursuit of something pure, right? Am I getting that vaguely correct?
Yeah, I mean, and you could see what is so subtly told in the story is that she hears it twice. From Jean and from her mother in the hospital room. And she grows up. And that's what the last scene is about. And there have been times, individual moments with them, where they can tennis, you know, they can play tennis back and forth, bum, 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 and then truth. Boom, truth, truth. And Carrie and Debbie both, they were just, you went over there to get a shot of truth. Whether it was about drugs or you or, you know, scoring or whatever, it was the truth. And I just realized she's gone.
Yeah. You know, I didn't know, and I can imagine that in 1987 that movie, because of the things that Mike Nichols interpreted that weren't right, you know, would have affected you and Carrie and Debbie. But I gotta say, to me, I watched it again, hadn't seen it in 30 years, watched it again last week. And pretty much all I take away from it is the look of Shirley down to Meryl at the end of the movie, which to me probably makes it okay.
Yeah, it does. You're right. The crashing. My mother never got a DUI, although she probably deserved it.
She did.
So.
that there was a night when we were all together at a hotel. It was the night that Carrie was given the ladies in film, one of the seven great women in film. It was a raucous evening. And we were sitting in this hotel room afterwards, and I was the only male there. And there were, I had a motto, which I have to redesign now, called, if you don't flirt, you die. And I flirted with seven women, Carrie and this, you know, and Debbie. And I was flirting with Debbie. And all of a sudden, she looked at me and she basically said, put up or shut up. Let me tell you, it was like I ran out of
Ladies and gentlemen, obviously you want more. I wish we could go on more. We got to get this theater in for another movie. Todd Fisher, everybody. Richard White.
Hopefully your tears have dried, because before we end this episode, I'd like to read some of your emails that I got in response to sharing your TCM classic film memories. Anna Roland writes, "The Great Nickelodeon Show was a delightful step back in time to what it was like going to the movies in 1910. It was a must-see experience. Audience participation was encouraged. Illustrated lyrics to bawdy songs were projected on the screen on hand-tinted magic lantern slides for the audience to follow along. Killer pianist extraordinaire Frederick Hodges was amazing to hear. Vaudeville acts were interspersed with newsreels of the assassination of President McKinley, and one-reelers that are rarely shown from George Méliès, Edwin S. Porter, and D.W. Griffith. Carrie Bible joined illusionist extraordinaire Reed Kirk Rallman as his assistant for an outrageous routine where he was going to pound a nail into his brain. She was a natural, giving him a hard time with wanting to do the deed. He said no, but liked her spunk. I found this event so entertaining and educational that it has inspired me to want to recreate a similar event in Austin, Texas." Anna, thank you so much for responding, and it sounds great. I was very upset to miss the Great Nickelodeon Show, but based on the audio you've heard over the last three episodes, I had a pretty packed slate. But it's great that you got to hang out with Carrie Bible. She's a great friend of mine, and she's always fun. So once again, thank you, Anna. This is going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please help the podcast out by leaving a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysandclassicfilm.com. And if you want to know more of my thoughts on the films that I've touched on during the last three episodes, I'm putting up individual reviews of those, slowly but surely. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to listen to episodes early or have me review your favorite film or talk about your favorite star? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast. If you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Next time, I'm talking with Raquel Stetcher about our top three favorite Robert Mitchum movies in honor of his upcoming centennial. So if you have a favorite Robert Mitchum movie or just want to talk about Robert Mitchum, send me an email or a tweet and you might hear it on the next episode. Till next time.